for improvements and so forth.
People have a hard time seeing the sense of it. We are out of time barely, and I would just, before I let you go, thank you so much for joining us today. Very grateful to you for being with us. And can you let listeners know where they can find out more about the actual costs of these types of all war, all the time policies?
Absolutely. Folks should go to nationalpriorities.org, and we have a new page called Cost of National Security, and you'll see the cost of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the cost right now of the weapon system that we're considering striking Syria with, the Tomahawk cruise missile.
Mazaya Karima, thank you so much for being with us. There's a great deal more to talk about this morning. Barrett Brown story is heating up, and perhaps we'll get to tomorrow. This has been our Cascadia for Monday, September 9th, 2013. My engineer this morning is Joe Clement. Thanks so much for that, Joe. Kathleen Stevenson is KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And it's good to be back after a five-week break from the show. This summer, the Port of Vancouver, Washington approved plans to build a terminal for oil trains over widespread opposition from the community. Meanwhile, anti-coal activists are still trying to fend off three proposed oil terminals in Oregon and Washington. And Kinder Morgan is going ahead promoting his plan to enlarge and extend its Trans Mountain pipeline that carries tar sands crude from Alberta to Burnaby, British Columbia. If they have their way, the Georgia Strait and Strait of San Juan de Fuca will become shipping channels for scores of supertankers carrying the heavy oil to refineries in California. This morning, we talk with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute in Seattle about what will happen to our region if these plans for oil and coal rail terminals and coal and oil rail corridors, pipelines, and terminals come to fruition. Eric is a researcher, writer, speaker, and policy analyst for the Sightline Institute. For more than a decade, he has spearheaded Sightline's work on climate and energy policy, emerging as a leading Northwest expert on strategies and policies to cut carbon emissions. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me, Barbara. It's good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you on. And I just got a call from a listener just before I went on the air, and he said that the Vancouver City Council shut down a meeting today where there was going to be public commentary about the proposed oil terminal in Vancouver. And they also put it off that they canceled the meeting for next week. And so it looks like the public comment period for people to oppose this terminal is shrinking. And I'm wondering if you heard any word about this and what your thoughts might be.
You know, I haven't heard any word about that, but it's completely consistent with what we've seen from the fossil fuel industry on these issues. We know that the more the public knows about coal and oil shipments, the less there is to like about it. And I like to say there's a little something for everyone to hate because people come to these issues from a whole range of different perspectives, but there's very little economic advantage or environmental advantage or really any advantage to most folks in the region. So, you know, the more consideration these projects get, the less popular they tend to get. You know, I haven't followed the ins and outs of the Vancouver project for the last couple of weeks since I've been blessedly free on vacation, but you know, that sort of behavior is completely consistent with what we know.
So I'm just wondering, in the past, have most of these projects, the kinds of oil and gas development that we've seen all around the country and actually a lot in Canada, has that just kind of popped up without a lot of public input? Is it a new thing that people are trying to have input into, having a say in whether these kinds of developments happen in their communities?
Yeah, I think it's worth sort of starting maybe a step back from there, which is to point out that we have, in the last couple of years, as a country and as a region, sort of entered a new phase of the energy economy. You know, for years and years, it was the case that the U.S. consumed a lot of coal. We mined a lot of coal. We consume a lot of coal. All of a sudden, in the last few years, our coal consumption has declined drastically, and there are a bunch of reasons for that I can go into later. But our coal consumption has declined drastically. And China's demand for imports has gone up, so that's led to a whole range of export proposals that have come online in the Northwest. Everyone knows about those, I think, at this point. That's a massive phase shift that's happened only in the last few years. With oil, we're seeing sort of a similar dynamic. With the rise of fracking techniques employed in the Bakken Formation of North Dakota and other places, we're suddenly seeing a world in which the U.S. is producing all kinds of oil, and there's, in addition to that, of course, the Canadian tar sands oil. And now we're starting to see the oil industry start to think about becoming an exporter, particularly off the Pacific coast. So now we're seeing a whole another range of pipeline and rail terminal proposals. That's new. This is new within even the last year or two. So, you know, we don't have, as a region or as a country, a long history of dealing with these kind of projects. We're seeing the fossil fuel industry in a mad dash to get this stuff to market. Over whatever opposition may stand in the way.
Well, it seems kind of curious to me that while we're really concerned about having energy security here at home, which is the excuse for the development of the Bakken oil fields and also the excuse for the Keystone XL pipeline, it seems that a lot of this oil is, in fact, and the coal as well, is destined for export. And I'm wondering, do we really need... Are we needing this oil development at all for our domestic supplies, or are we continuing to import oil while we export oil at the same time?
You raise an incredibly germane point, which is that the phrase energy independence or energy security often ends up being a stalking horse for what amounts to a strategy for exports. And if, the actual fossil fuel markets vary and they're dynamic, but it is clear to me that the rail projects we're talking about, it's clear to me that the oil pipeline projects we're talking about are in some fashion based around exports. This is about moving North American petroleum products into the Pacific market. And in fact, if you go and look at what the American Petroleum Institute is doing now in Congress, what the kind of the oil industry advocates are doing in Congress, they're already starting to talk about lifting a long-term ban we've had on exporting U.S. crude oil and just getting that stuff to market as fast as possible overseas. So it's not about, this is not about energy independence for the U.S. This is about fracking and drilling in North America and moving that stuff to foreign markets.
Well, I'm kind of curious, if all this oil is actually going to be exported, what are we going to burn here in this country?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, it's obvious to everyone, I think, that that fuel prices are quite high right now. I think it's fair to say that they're expected to remain high for some time. And as we hitch ourselves closer and closer to international markets for petroleum, we'll see prices remain high and perhaps climb even higher than they are now. So, there are, I think, kind of long-term structural questions about, well, what does that do to American energy consumption? How stable is it, either economically or just in terms of supply? And there's kind of a whole thicket of questions about there that I think nobody really has a good answer to at this point. As I said, the markets are dynamic, and it's not clear how any of these projects are going to sort of unfold in the future. Many of them are very, very new.
Well, I want to talk about one project, which I think is probably the least well-known in this region, and that's the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which already exists, and it runs from Edmonton to Burnaby, British Columbia, carrying tar sands crude. But Kinder Morgan, the pipeline owner, wants to vastly expand that pipeline, I guess double it in capacity at least, and extend it, as I understand, down to Anacortes. And this would be shipping oil, actually, unlike the other notorious pipeline that Enbridge wants to bring up to way northern British Columbia to Kitimat, which would ship oil to Asia. The one that would terminate in Burnaby and Anacortes would actually be shipping oil down to Long Beach, California, and hopefully, in their mind, Richmond, California, if the Richmond Chevron refinery ever upgrades itself against the community's wishes. So I want to talk about that whole the pipeline issue. We've been hearing an awful lot about the Keystone XL pipeline that would go from the tar sands up in Alberta down to the coastline of Texas, but we haven't heard very much about the Trans Mountain pipeline. I know it's something that Sightline's concerned about, so let's talk a little bit about what that's about.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you're absolutely right. I mean, as a nation, we've been focused on the Keystone XL pipeline to a large degree, and that's appropriate. It's a very significant and dangerous project. The Trans Mountain pipeline, you would think more people would know about, but as a matter of fact, most people don't in this region. The Trans Mountain pipeline moves Canadian oil to Burnaby, British Columbia. As you said, it's currently got a capacity of about 300,000 barrels per day. It's running slightly above capacity at the moment. The project that Kinder Morgan has in mind is often called twinning the pipeline, which people take to mean doubling, but actually they're almost tripling it. That's their proposal, to move it up to about 890,000 barrels per day. That fuel will then move to Burnaby, where it can be put on tankers, and there are also spur lines from the Trans Mountain pipeline that feed oil down to the refineries at Ferndale in Washington and Anacortes in Washington. And it's that product gets refined there and then put into gas tanks in Oregon and Washington. Most of the refined fuel in western Oregon, or northwestern Oregon anyway, in western Washington, comes out of those refineries, which can be supplied from the Trans Mountain pipeline. As you said, when and if Kinder Morgan is successful in nearly tripling the capacity of that pipeline route, that's going to open up a huge gateway potentially for tar sands oil. Some tar sands is already moving through that pipeline. And if we get to a place where we're talking about 890,000 barrels per day moving to the population centers of the Vancouver region and Washington and Oregon, it puts us in a place where the Northwest becomes one of the leading purveyors and consumers of tar sands oil. And it's not clear whether or not all that stuff would be refined and consumed domestically or whether it would be put on tankers and shipped overseas. It's, again, one of those areas where there's a lot of uncertainty, but none of the possible outcomes look good for the planet. None of them look good for communities, for that matter.
Well, I want to talk a bit about the opposition on a whole lot of different levels and stages along that proposal. And first of all, the pipeline expansion is proposed to go through largely First Nation lands in British Columbia, and in British Columbia in particular, First Nations have a lot more autonomy and they basically have a lot more control over their own destiny than most tribes do in the United States or in the rest of Canada, for that matter. So the opposition, the tribal opposition, is I think majority, at least if not overwhelmingly, opposed to the pipeline. So that's one big obstacle. And another big obstacle. Well, then there's another obstacle in the Vancouver area, which there's a lot of organizing to try to stop the pipeline there, or to stop the expansion, and that there's a lot of opposition in Vancouver to becoming a major shipping channel for supertankers. And then finally, down in Richmond, California, which is one of the destination refineries, there's a lot of opposition in that community for Chevron, quote, upgrading its facilities. They say so they won't have any more fires like they had last year, but in fact, the upgrade is planned so that they can start to process bitumen for making it into usable fuel. And the community is opposed both on this, a lot of opposition they have to what's going on in the Chevron plant and the complete lackadaisicalness about any kind of safety there, but also overall opposition to tar sands and the greenhouse gases affected. So I want to look at the streamline of opposition that it faces, and how well do you think that the opponents to the Trans Mountain pipeline at its different places can be effective in really stopping this whole process from the oil getting from the tar sands all the way down to Richmond, California?
Yeah, that's a very good and in some ways complicated question. As you say, the First Nations in Canada do have sort of a different legal status than many of the tribes in the U.S. do, and that's principally because they never signed treaties. So in some ways, they're more like sovereign governments even than our tribes are here, which, of course, should be treated like sovereign governments. But you know, the issue of how effective the advocates can be and opponents can be, I think, is difficult to know. The Canadian government has an ability to put projects in place in some ways more sort of quote-unquote efficiently than the U.S. government can. which means that they can, in many respects, ride roughshod over local opposition. Where, for example, on the Columbia River, we're looking at these coal export terminals that are going to have to go through extensive permitting and review and public process. That's not necessarily the case on the Canadian side of the border. And so you can imagine a scenario in which the government is successful in allowing Kinder Morgan to just go right ahead and build that pipeline. And it's important to point out that the Canadian federal government is very boosterish about this stuff. They want the pipelines built. And, you know, the Harper administration in Canada makes no bones about wanting to move as much tar sands oil to market as possible. So that's a big problem. It's a big problem for local activists in British Columbia. Then there's the question of, well, what happens in the local communities where that tar sand, where that bitumen is destined, such as Richmond and refineries in Washington as well? As a procedural matter, it can also be difficult to stop a refinery from receiving certain kinds of feedstocks. And none of my sort of bearishness about the difficulty of this in any way suggests that we shouldn't figure out a way to prevent it, because the thought of shipping that much oil through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, down the coast, putting in pipelines through First Nations territory, through wilderness areas, is a deeply irresponsible, just horrifying environmental policy. And so despite the fact that it's going to be very difficult to oppose these things, we're going to need strong and consistent public opposition to this stuff. The good news, though, is that the more folks hear about this stuff, the more folks who know anything about it at all, the less likely it is, because it's just so unpopular. There's so few advantages to anyone in the region to doing this that a lot of it, I think, at this point, is just simply kind of bringing up a level of awareness around these issues.
Well, this morning we're talking with Eric DePlace, who is with Sightline Institute, and we're talking about coal trains, oil trains, and pipelines that we'd like to transform the Pacific Northwest from the green haven that we more or less are to part of the hydrocarbon complex, global hydrocarbon complex that sort of radiates out of the northeastern corner of Alberta. Well, you mentioned that the Canadian government is a real booster for this, and in fact, the Canadian government and the Albertan government seem to become synonymous now, since Harper is from Alberta and seems to have brought the petropolitics of Alberta to the federal level in Canada. But there's a lot of opposition in British Columbia, though my understanding is that the Prime Minister of British Columbia is a little, she's kind of waffling, or she's maybe two-faced about the whole thing, but she's come out against the Northern Gateway pipeline. However, I haven't heard any word about what her stand is on the Trans Mountain pipeline. And I wonder, I'm not sure how much you're following the Northern Gateway pipeline. Is that something you're following, Eric?
I am, yes.
Okay. So there's the opposition on the part of the First Nations is even more vocal and better known, I think, than Trans Mountain. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the difference in the geopolitics of those two pipelines.
Yeah. Well, I think I actually want to talk about the similarity, or what I hope to be the similarity between them, because the defeat, or what looks like maybe the chance of a defeat for the Northern Gateway pipeline, is a very encouraging sign. So as a bit of context, the Northern Gateway pipeline was a proposal put in place by Enbridge, which is a large energy company in Canada and also in the U.S., and they had planned to ship essentially tar sands oil across the mountains in northern B.C. to Kitimat and then put it on tankers for points abroad.
And let's just mention that Kitimat, though it's a small town that has had some has a port and it's had some shipping in and out of it, you're basically talking about one of the last really pristine places in the North American coast, and it's a home to whales and wolves and grizzly bear, and it's a relatively unbroken habitat. So to imagine this turning into another Richmond, California, which would probably be what it would be doing to it, is to me very mind-boggling.
I couldn't have said it better. That's exactly right. So the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline remains a very serious proposal, and everyone sort of thought it was a done deal for a long time. But with a combination of extremely effective opposition by the First Nations and by environmental activists and by many others, it looks like the BC provincial government is backing away from that one and wants to give it a pass. That was a David and Goliath moment when they announced that. That was, this little band of opponents trotting out against what looked like an overwhelming, energy force to move that tar sands oil. in a new pipeline. And it looks like the good guys are going to win in that circumstance.
It was kind of interesting because in the middle of this battle, Enbridge was arguing that there's no environmental dangers posed by the pipeline because bitumen doesn't spill. And then there was a big bitumen spill. I think it was in Arkansas, actually, and kind of made it we got to see graphically what happens when bitumen spills.
Right, and because it's a very dense and heavy oil, it's very problematic to clean up. So it's a very nasty substance. We don't want it in the environment at all. And when it does spill, and it does, of course, spill, as you point out, it's an even bigger problem than conventional crude oil supplies.
Now, Eric, I think we should back up for a moment. Maybe there's listeners who don't know what bitumen is. So why don't we just spend a moment describing what that is?
Sure. So there is that's a great point. We typically think of oil, maybe like we have some image of somebody going out into Oklahoma and drilling a well, and it sort of gushes up from the ground, and then we cap the well and bring it out and turn it into gasoline. In Canada, where the tar sands are mined, the bitumen is actually much more like sludge. It's almost just this side of coal, if you will. So it's this dense, kind of sticky hydrocarbon. It's often mined. It has to be extensively heated and processed in order to turn it into anything that even resembles conventional oil. And then even then, it usually has to be mixed with what they call a diluent, so some lighter form of hydrocarbon. And then it can go into refinery, which, if the refinery has been, quote-unquote, upgraded to deal with this kind of nasty sludge, it can turn it eventually into gasoline and kerosene, jet fuel, and all the other stuff that we get out of oil supplies. But it is this. It is not. It is unlike oil as we have typically thought about it, and it's much more. It's like tar, basically.
Isn't it kind of like asphalt?
It's like asphalt. Yeah, and in some cases, it actually is almost as hard as asphalt. So it has to be. It's a very just kind of. I mean, just kind of physically yucky. But it's also very energy intensive to get that stuff out and then to turn it into anything that we can even refine. So it's. From an environmental perspective, it's a super sort of nasty and dangerous product. And probably the highest and best use for it is to hold up the ground in Alberta, where it should remain forever. But, the Harper administration has other designs for that product.
Well, actually, coming show, I'm going to be talking more about the tar sands. I'm going up to start doing some interviews about it. Tomorrow, I'll be in Calgary talking to oil industry people, so it should be very interesting what I learn from them about their defense of what they're doing up there. So maybe we can talk about this again later on this winter when I come back armed with more information myself. I want to move to... Before we move to the moving pipelines of oil trains, I just want to talk about your sense of what's happening with the Trans Mountain Pipeline. I have heard, and you just said, that the Northern Gateway Pipeline is possibly, and maybe even more than possibly, a dead deal. But does the Trans Mountain Pipeline soldier on?
At the moment, it looks like the Trans Mountain Pipeline is soldiering on. It's always difficult to know kind of how stoppable these things are. Kinder Morgan is the company that owns and operates that pipeline. They're a very dangerous company. They have they're very profitable. They were kind of spun out of the ashes of Enron, they're not stupid. They have shown themselves to be willing to go to great lengths to accomplish their ends. And they also have a pretty lousy environmental track record. They have, in fact, had, pretty egregious oil spills already in the Burnaby area from their existing pipeline. Their coal terminals that they have around the U.S. are replete with pollution and, irresponsible lawbreaking. I actually wrote a whole report about Kinder Morgan's lawbreaking. In fact, in the Portland area, they own a terminal space in Portland, and they actually at one time took potassium chloride that they didn't want that had been contaminated, just took it out to sea and dumped it in the Pacific, just straight off the decks. Nobody had seen anything like that in a long time. So they're a very problematic corporation. It may turn out that they're stoppable. If we can get enough folks in British Columbia, Oregon, and Washington who are, in California, ultimately going to be the consumers for this product, to realize that we're doing business with somebody we don't want to be doing business with, perhaps it is possible to get them to abandon their sort of schemes for tripling the size of that pipeline.
Now, am I correct that Kinder Morgan is also involved with some of the coal terminals proposed for the Columbia River?
They had proposed a very large coal terminal for the Lower Columbia at Port Westward, so sort of northwest of Portland, about, I guess, 50 miles or so. And they came in late with a project that they provided very few details about. And then after about a year, they backed away from it. And nobody really knows why. The port there was unwilling to disclose, even pretty rudimentary pieces of information about that proposal. And they were unwilling to provide really any good reason for why they backed out. What we do know is that, as with most of these projects, the public, and this goes from the local community all the way to sort of the regional level, was pretty opposed to those projects. You know, if you talk about moving, I think it was about 38 or 40 million tons of coal on trains through Portland and route to Port Westward every day, every year. That's a huge problem from both an economic standpoint and an environmental standpoint. Kinder Morgan backed away from that project, as I said. We don't know if they're planning to resurface somewhere else, but we do know that for the time being, they seem to have abandoned their coal dreams, at least for Oregon.
I was just imagining an informational campaign to heighten awareness about Kinder Morgan. I was just imagining the big Enron E emblazoned across the Kinder Morgan logo. Because I think that if people were aware, I didn't realize actually until I was talking to Trish Webber down in Corvallis a few months ago that Kinder Morgan was in fact two of the guys from Enron. And it gave me a lot more pause to think about just, you know, where they're coming from and probably just how cagey and savvy they are. But it seems like that in itself is bad branding. If they could be rebranded as Enron, it might help.
I like the idea. I think it's a good thing to point out. And they did pick up many of the pieces of Enron and reconstituted as Kinder Morgan. And they're sort of notorious in Wall Street circles for being aggressive players and for turning a profit. So that's where their eyes are. It's always on the money. And that's of course a problem if you happen to be located near any of their facilities. But it's worth pointing out that one of the key pieces for the reason that Kinder Morgan backed away is that Portland General Electric actually has some natural gas fired turbines in that area, and when they realized that Kinder Morgan wanted to have a very large coal pile nearby, they took a look at the project, and it turned out that the port had to sort of take some PGE land. And the PGE leases now and transfer it temporarily or permanently, semi-permanently to Kinder Morgan. PGE looked at that and said, "No way. We know Kinder Morgan isn't capable of keeping the coal dust contained from that coal, or isn't interested in keeping it contained. And if that coal dust affects our gas turbines, we'll have a real problem." So you had an instance in which you have a utility that itself handles and burns coal, looked at Kinder Morgan's proposal and said, "That's crazy. We'd be crazy to allow that near our turbines."
It's kind of ironic considering that PGE was for a period PGE Enron. Maybe they know better than anybody just what the problems are.
And that's yet another fillip in the story. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk some about the oil trains, which I think people are starting to become a little bit more aware of. But this is in addition to the coal trains, which we are on possibly the cusp of stopping the coal trains, but now we are faced with the oil trains. So let's talk a little bit about what that's about. And I mean, as we were emailing back and forth yesterday, I mean, in fact, a lot of people are seeing oil trains as mobile pipelines. And what are some of the advantages for the oil industry to put oil on trains rather than putting it through pipelines?
Yeah, the oil trains issue is fascinating. It's fascinating even from the industry perspective because it's emerged so quickly that nobody really has a good handle on it until sort of right about now. What happened is that you have there are actually several examples of this, but this is the particularly good one is in sort of western North Dakota and the surrounding area. You have some oil formations, sometimes known as the Bakken Formation. It's actually not like tar sands. It's a lighter oil. And through a combination of drilling techniques and fracking techniques, those fields have started producing huge quantities of oil. The problem from the perspective of the oil industry is that there's no pipeline infrastructure, very little pipeline infrastructure in place to serve that oil, to move it to market. And so what's happened is that the rail industry has said, "Oh, well, wait, we don't need to build any pipelines. Those are controversial. They take a long time. People don't like them. What we'll do instead is we'll put it in tanker cars and we'll move that stuff to port terminals and refineries in railroads on railroad lines, and here's a benefit: the federal government preempts any local or state governments from regulating the rail industry. So, you know, if you don't like the pipelines, guess what? You can't do anything about the oil trains. That's been their reasoning. It turns out to not be totally right, but that's been their reasoning. And so it was about September of last year, September 2012, the first time the Northwest saw any oil train. That was the very first unit train arrived in Anacortes in September. Since then, we've seen this just explosion of proposals for oil train shipments, including a monstrous one of just titanic proportions at the Port of Vancouver, but also in Grace Harbor area and also in Puget Sound. So this is going to be, the oil train issue is going to be, in my judgment, kind of the big energy fight for folks in Western Oregon, Western Washington, in the next, you know, year or two.
Well, this morning, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's with Sightline Institute in Seattle. He's been a frequent guest here on Locus Focus, and we're talking this morning about oil trains, coal trains, and pipelines, and the transformation of the Pacific Northwest into part of the petrostate. So what is it about oil trains that concerns you the most, let's say? And I guess a lot of us have images of that horrible fire in Quebec at the beginning of the summer that was started by an oil train, caused by an oil train that was unmanned and just happened to, the brakes let go and the train just moved into town and derailed and blew up the town.
Yeah, before the Quebec disaster, I would have said that my biggest concern was that we had an oil industry out of control and we didn't properly understand it. That's still a big concern. Now my biggest concern is that we're going to see another Quebec-style disaster. That train is very similar to the tanker, the tanker cars and the oil trains we have in the Northwest right now. It was carrying the same kind of fuel. It was carrying oil from the Bakken Formation. It was not believed that crude oil would explode like that. So what happened is that when that train derailed, four of the 72 cars in that train exploded, and they killed almost 50 people, I think, in this relatively small town in Quebec, leveled blocks of the town. You know, from where I'm standing right now as I'm doing this interview, there are oil trains running once or twice a day through downtown Seattle, just a few blocks from here. Some of them run through a tunnel under downtown, and then they emerge in the northern waterfront right by a sculpture park. You know, do local first responders know how to deal with this stuff? No. Do local governments even know when the stuff is moving? No. The railroads won't tell us. Do we have adequate safety plans in place, even spill response plans in place? Absolutely not. There is a very real, in my mind, concern about how dangerous these things are to our communities, and we don't even know how much they're moving, when they're moving them, where they are. That's a big problem, and it has nothing to do with environmental issues. It's everything to do with basic public health and safety. Then, in addition to that,
let's get to the environmental issues now. Yeah.
Then, in addition to that, there are huge environmental concerns. If all the projects that are planned were to get built and operated, we'd be looking at about 800,000 barrels of oil per day. So that's a, you know, kind of a ballpark keystone level of oil, but moving in trains around the region. And you know, so you're talking about a huge amount of carbon emissions and simply a huge amount of fuel, much of which could end up being exported to Asian markets.
Well, I think a lot of us have an image of the Northwest which is kind of diametrically opposed to the image of New Orleans, let's say, or other places, New Jersey, places that we think of, Terminal Island in Southern California, that are the bastions of the oil patch, so to speak. What would happen to this region if all these proposed oil terminals are built in Vancouver and near Anacortes, and if the coal train... Well, let's just stick with the oil for now, because the coal trains, I'm actually kind of cautiously optimistic, might not happen. But the oil trains, I'm particularly hearing that Vancouver City Council called off its public comment period today around the oil terminal. It makes me concerned. So how would it transform this region if we have not only all these oil trains coming through the region, but actually these terminals where then the oil is transferred from the trains to the ships and sent to wherever they go?
Yeah, I mean, it turns us from the region that, you know, sort of gave birth to Greenpeace and the first carbon tax and recycling laws and bottle bills and, you know, bicycling. And this region that is, I think, justifiably known for a green, progressive reputation, it turns us into a Gulf Coast. It turns us into a big piece of the petroleum industry. And you know, if you sort of think about a map of the world, you can think about these huge fossil fuel deposits in the center of North America, whether it's tar sands or Bakken oil or whether it's coal, natural gas. And you can think about the big markets in East Asia, in China particularly, but many other places. And then you think about the shortest line between those two places, between these big fossil deposits and between these big markets. And those lines run directly through the Pacific Northwest. So we will become, if the energy industry has its way, we will become a major transshipment point for clean oil, for light oil, for heavy oil, for natural gas, for coal. And it would turn us into a very different part globally of the energy economy, and I think that would be a mistake, both from a regional identity perspective, but certainly from a global environmental perspective, it would be a huge problem.
Well, there's also I'm rereading Andrew Nikiforuk's book on tar sands, and he's got this interesting chapter there about petropolitics, basically, and how petroleum resources transform regions, states, in his case Alberta, into petrostates, and the difference politically between a petrostate and a democracy. And I wonder, I mean, we see that in Texas. I think we see that in Louisiana. We may be starting to see that in North Dakota. The only petrostate that we don't see it in is California, I guess, because it's so vast that there's a lot of other things pulling besides the vast oil resources there. So do you see that there's a potential that we could lose our independent political streak, some of the real grassroots democratic processes that were birthed in the Northwest, that could also be challenged if petroleum transportation and shipping became a major focus and a major source of income for this region?
I do. I do think that's a very real danger. You know, right now we're at a place where these schemes for oil and coal and so on, you know, look like negatives, and because they are negatives, they'll shut down streets. They'll, you know, put communities at risk. They carry huge environmental price tags. You know, if we get to a place where there's a strong local oil industry, we have this a little bit in Washington, actually, more so than Oregon, because we have oil refineries here. That can really play havoc with politics. It can really have a pernicious influence. You know, to give you one example of something that happened in Washington during this last session, you know, some folks tried to close this obscure 50-year-old tax loophole that was put in place purely by accident for sawmills. The oil industry had later come in, exploited the language in the loophole, now captures about 96% of that tax loophole benefit. And we've been unable to close, and the closure of the tax loophole was to fund public education, which is in shorthanded now in Washington. We've been unable to close that tax loophole purely because the local oil refineries didn't want to pay a few million extra bucks a year. And that's just one small example of the sort of pernicious influence that the fossil fuel sort of energy interest can have on a government. And it would be a real shame for that to be expanded in power and for it to you know, move into places like Oregon and beyond.
So the center of the oil industry in Washington is in Anacortes. Is that true?
We actually have four large refineries and one small one. Two are north of Bellingham in the sort of Ferndale Cherry Point area, and then two other big ones in Anacortes. And those refineries end up producing most of the refined product that we put in gas tanks. You know, kind of, but certainly in the Portland area and north. Sometimes in the Willamette Valley as well.
And so how much of that oil that's coming into those refineries now is coming from the tar sands fields in Alberta?
Nobody knows exactly how much. We think it's probably in the range of 10 or 15%, depending on the refinery, but it's difficult to make general statements about it. You know, historically, most of that oil has come from Alaska's North Slope, with Canada playing a sort of secondary role. What we're seeing now is pressure to change that mix so that there's more coming from Canada and more of the Canadian fuel is tar sands. A lot of that stuff is not publicly available, so we don't actually know for sure.
Well, it seems like another concern about developing this region as being an export base for the petrochemical industry is that we're working so hard, so many of us, to try to get us off of oil and to develop new renewable and non-polluting resources for generating both power and also transportation. How do you see that this big splurge of tar sands oil, what kind of impact would you see that having on our ability to like really shift direction and get off of oil?
Yeah, well, you know, if you take a look at what's going on in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia too, you see that left to our own devices, so to speak, we would be on this assertive path toward genuine energy independence, genuine renewable energy. We have plans in place to reduce carbon emissions. These are imperfect but real plans. They're happening. All three of those places I just mentioned, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, have all been, I think, as I said, imperfect but somewhat successful and making good progress toward reducing carbon emissions. If we put this stuff in place, it dwarfs any of the good intentions, any of the small positive steps that we've made so far. We've talked about shutting down or eventually transitioning the Boardman plant offline, which is the only coal plant in Oregon, same for the only coal plant in Washington on a somewhat slower time scale. If we go forward with these projects, that stuff is a rounding error, because we're looking at, if you take all the fossil fuel projects, all the sort of real-life fossil fuel projects in those three places, we're talking about the carbon impact of, I don't know, 6, 7, maybe 8 Keystone XL pipelines. That's a real hard number, and I'd be happy to document that for anybody who questions the math. But I'm talking about maybe 7 Keystone XL pipelines worth of carbon moving through Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. So, you know, our good intentions will be simply dwarfed by the scale of environmental destruction that would be unleashed by these projects.
Well, in the remaining moment that we have, what do you recommend that people do to protect the Pacific Northwest that we know and love and to stop these oil trains, coal trains, and pipelines from becoming a reality?
Yeah, I mean, this sounds cliche, but it's not. You know, our governors need to hear from us. Our federal delegates in Congress need to hear from us clearly, loudly, and repeatedly. And we need to be speaking up when we have an opportunity to speak up, and even when we don't. Folks in Portland should be very interested in what the Port of Vancouver is doing, because the Columbia River could very well be home to massive quantities of oil on vessels and barges. Be at those meetings, badger the Port of Vancouver. It matters to Portland. It matters to other places around the region. And don't forget to talk to your elected representatives often.
And they can also visit your website. Is there information on the Sightline website that might help people?
That's right. Sightline.org is the best place to find that. You can also sort of Google Sightline blog, and you'll find my research located in one of those two places or both of them.
And we have that link on our website for the page for this show, so you can check that out when we get off the air. So I want to thank you very much for joining us, Eric. It's always good to talk to you, and let's check in a couple months and we can talk more about tar sands.
Definitely. Thanks again, Barbara. It's so good to be on the show.
Okay, thanks a lot. I've been talking with Eric DePlace with the Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus, and we'll have links to Sightline and to some of the articles that Eric and other people at Sightline have written about oil trains, coal trains, and pipelines. Next week, my guest is Dominic Della Sala from Ashland, and he's going to give us the latest on the wildfires this summer. My engineer is Joe Clements. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I'll be back next week with more.
Paul Butterfield.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is just before 11 o'clock. Up next will be Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall focusing on Cover Oregon. I'd like to make an announcement today. Congress comes back into session on today, September 9th, and is scheduled to take up President Obama's bill for the authorization to use military force against Syria. At 4 p.m. today, there will be an action to say no war in Syria. Protesters will be gathering at the Federal Building in downtown at 1220 Southwest 3rd. They will be surrounding the building, forming a human chain, and letting Congress know that they do not support the war. That's today at 4 p.m. at the Federal Building at Southwest 3rd and Madison.
Bring out your book.
Bring out your books.
KBOO's preparing for our legendary book and record sale.
We are accepting your donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, and VHS tapes. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit. KBOO, bring your donations to the stations at 20 Southeast 8 between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. weekdays.
Questions? Contact Ani by email at volunteer@kboo.org or by phone at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
If you have a larger donation,
call to arrange a pickup. The last day to donate is Tuesday, September 24th. So don't wait. Bring in those CDs, LPs, books, and DVDs right away. Thank you.